Welcome to the Rocks Back Pages podcast. My name is Barney Hoskins. I'm here with my colleague Mark Pringle.
Hi, Barney.
We're here with our special guest, Tammy Faye Starlight, all the way from New York City. Welcome.
Oh, thank you very much, and I'm very honored to be here.
It's lovely to have you here, Tammy.
Thank you so much.
We are going to be talking a little further down the line about Miles Davis, and we're going to be talking about D.A. Pennebaker, the late D.A. Pennebaker, filmmaker. We're going to be talking about everything that's new on Rocks Back Pages this week. But we are going to be mainly talking about you, Tammy.
Oh,
and
God.
Even more specifically about you.
Just had everybody turn off the podcast.
But we'll talk you as Marianne Faithfull.
Oh, yeah.
Tammy as Marianne.
Oh, yeah.
So to put this in context for our listeners, you are essentially you're a performance artist.
I suppose you could say that.
Well, you're a musician, but you're a performance artist. And what you're doing next month in New York, and you've put this show on at least once already, but
yeah.
You are performing Marianne's brilliant 1979 album, Broken English.
Yes.
In its entirety.
In its entirety.
Am I right?
Yeah. Yes, you are.
And there's more. So tell us a little bit more about this.
Well, Broken English I had done in its entirety originally in 2014 at Lincoln Center.
So prestigious.
Yeah, I know.
Look at
right?
you.
They had
Lincoln
me.
Center.
I knew the wonderful man, Bill Bragan, who booked the atrium at Lincoln Center, and I was begging him, which I do, that's why I'm on the show, because I pretty much Lucy Ricardo my way onto everything. Like, please have me on your show, please. And so I would beg him, and I had been doing a show about Nico, and which
absolutely
actually came, it was before that and after the Marianne, but when I said to him, you know, I was thinking of doing Marianne Faithfull's Broken English because it was at the suggestion of a musician I'd been working with, Kevin Salem, who said, why don't you do Broken English? I thought, oh my God,
yeah.
It's one of my favorite albums from, you know, my teenage years. And not that it came out when I was a teenager, but
it's timeless.
It's timeless.
It's timeless, Tammy.
I was barely a teenager. But so I asked Bill Bragan, how about Broken English? And he had such a soft spot for Marianne for that particular album. He said, yes. And so I did that. And I just kind of extemporized monologues before each song. And then I did a kind of Marianne, you know, I think I called it Cabaret Marianne, where it was just a melange of her songs. And that was reviewed in the Times in 2015. And at that point, I was working with Barry Reynolds, who was
yes.
her co-writer and
probably her most notable collaborator.
Yeah,
her, in many ways.
Her Keith Richards, in a
her
sense.
Keith Richards.
You know?
Yes.
I mean,
well, we'll probably come on to her relationship
exactly.
with Keith.
Well, there are similarities that I'm sure that, you know.
Sure.
You know, that there are several similarities. They both play guitar, and there's another thing that they both
have in common.
Marianne. So,
I can't think what you're talking about.
Does this
get acted out in the performance?
Well, you'll have to come see. You know, there are very loose laws in
loose.
New York
yeah.
cabaret and theater. So, I decided, and then when I was doing, and it sounds so salacious, I was doing Marianne in New York at Joe's Pub, and you know, and then at Lincoln Center, and then at this club, Pangea, where I'm performing now, and I heard through a few people that she was not pleased that I was doing it. And I understand, because I wouldn't want that either. You know, screw you. I don't
yeah.
take my persona,
right.
you know, upstart. you know, Eve Harrington.
Ms. Starlight. She's very light. I was listening to the audio, and it was like, that's who she reminds me of, Bette Davis.
Oh, is she? Yeah. Oh,
yes.
Crossed with Keith Richards.
Yeah, crossed with Keith. Yeah, she's very brilliant. And, you know, she has this kind of aristocratic air.
Oh, yeah.
And she is an aristocrat.
Oh, she won't let you forget it.
No.
No.
For a second.
And God bless, because
she's probably a baroness.
Her mother was a baroness.
Yes. That's right.
Eva von Sacher-Masoch.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Tell me about Broken English. Broken English. Can we contextualize
yeah.
that in the Marianne story?
Well, so I heard that she wasn't thrilled with me. And I decided not to do Marianne for a while. And then last November, I realized that 2019 would be the 40th anniversary of Broken English. So I decided to ask her via Facebook if I could Do it.
Brave.
And I thought, well, I thought, you know, it's that whole YOLO, you know, you only live once. So just like such a, it's my trite, you know, motto. I have a few mottos, but that's
it's going to be mine now.
Yeah, it should be
YOLO, YOLO.
Like anything you do, just, you know, that kind of is a blanket cover for any, you know, insane thing that you do. So I messaged her on Facebook saying that it was going to be the 40th anniversary and I would love to do this album because I'm always thinking of what can I do next, you know, what project that nobody is asking me to do can I do next. So I said, I'll only do it with your blessing. And she wrote back, oh, do it, darling. It'll be great. And I thought, oh, my God. I'm free. I can do this. And Barry was back in town. He'd been out of town. And I contacted him. And my husband is also in the band. And he's a musician and a great one. And
what does he play?
In this show, he plays bass. He also plays guitar, piano. He teaches. He's magnificent and knows everything about rock and roll. If you ever have him on, you'll hear everything, you know,
it'll be longer than the spoken word, you know, middle mark.
I actually made him hate watch Bohemian Rhapsody with me so he could just watch it with me on Amazon so you can tell me everything that's wrong.
Did you say hate watch.
Yeah, because I knew
you
that
have
he would
from
hate
New York
it.
To explain these yeah. terms to
it's funny because I got into, on Facebook again, I got yeah. into rouse with various of our American journalists mm-hmm. who are obsessed about the inaccuracies in the
oh,
film.
Yeah.
And I keep saying, it's not a documentary.
Yeah, and yet there was, you know, he kept saying, okay, that song didn't come out
exactly.
then, that didn't come
yeah.
out then, that didn't happen at Live Aid, that's not... So, anyway, that's my husband. But so Barry is in the show, and Esther Ballant, who has been playing violin with me, which is a gift. She was in Jim Jarmusch's Stranger Than Paradise. She's in his latest movie. Yeah. So, yeah, so I decided to do Broken English, and I decided to connect each song with one of the seven deadly sins, even though there are eight songs. The eighth one is...
You invented an eighth sin.
An eighth sin. The eighth one is kind of a, you know, it's a summation of... It's all the sins, because it's Why'd You Do It, is the
yeah.
eighth song. So
the last song on the album.
Yeah, the last song.
It was a Heathcote Williams poem.
Yes.
Set to music.
It was.
And for those who haven't heard it, I mean, I remember when this album came out.
Yeah.
I was like, I don't know, 20 or something. And I was so shocked by it, because the C word was the first time I ever heard the C word on a record.
Yeah, I don't think it had ever...
And it's such a... It's just a brilliant song, isn't it? Brilliant way to end
the
album.
Oh my God, it's brilliant. And
it's a song. Can you explain what the song is?
I describe it in the show as in the form of a dialogue about a man who's telling his lady friend, shall we say.
Delicately put.
Yeah, about, he had just told her about an affair that he'd had, and this is her response. And she's asking the question, why'd you do it? And she gives various reasons. She posits various reasons why. And they include the C word, the D word, and...
It's so graphic,
it's
isn't
so
it?
Graphic.
You know, that the line about
yeah.
her...
Every time I...
In the bed, in our bed.
See,
I mean, it's
your,
this most sort of...
Yeah.
One of the most powerful songs about sexual jealousy
that's
ever been written.
Very, very, very
all
powerful.
Set to music.
The music was written by Barry and Joe Mavity, who was her lead guitarist at the
right.
time, and I think the whole band kind of chimed in, and she says in her book that it's a kind of, I think she says it, unless I say, maybe, I can't, now I can't remember if I made this up, or if she actually said this, but it's kind of like Jimmy Cliff meets Jimi Hendrix, because she says there are Jimi Hendrix. Part of it was, it's a little the melodies all along the Watchtower, Jimi Hendrix's version. So, but Barry kind of put a reggae...
It's a sort of cod reggae, it is a cod reggae class.
Yeah.
Reggae. We're big on cod reggae.
Oh, yeah, so...
Yes.
Fishy rhythms.
Fishy rhythms. I guess Barry will like that. So I connect each song to one of the seven deadly sins, and I have monologues before each song. And in March, I realized I didn't connect... why I was talking about the seven deadly sins. There was no, and they're only alluded to until at the end when I say it. But then, now I've kind of scrapped the old beginning, which was her rediscovering her youth and the year 1979 in particular, and how that was the last year before everything went to hell.
Yes.
Let's say, you know, it
yes.
was the last year before, you know, it was before Reagan. It was, you know, and
sure.
Margaret Thatcher had just been elected prime minister. So
when the album came out,
yeah,
that's right.
So it was indicative of a tectonic shift. And so it was the last gasp of real freedom that we had.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there are probably several years like that that people would think, oh, it was 62 before Kennedy was assassinated the next year, you know. Or But for me, it's 1979, because I have a distinct memory of in 1980, especially when Reagan was elected. Even though I was young, there was like a pall that was cast over the earth.
You know? That's a very nice way of putting it. Yeah, it's still there.
So it's, you know, we kind of go back to 79, and then I just do monologues that they seem pretty associative, but they're written, which I don't always do. I sometimes just extemporize.
So when Amy Linden came in the other day.
I love Amy.
She's wonderful, and she was absolutely hilarious.
Oh, she was so
funny. It was a great episode. And she mentioned you, and she talked about the way you actually take material from interviews that people like Nico and Marianne have done.
Yeah.
With the Marianne, is that the case that you've done?
No. Okay. I mean, I kind of call certain, you know, bits and pieces of dialogue that she's said in interviews that I've listened to over and over and that I've read. But the Nico play that I did in 2014 was based on that Melbourne interview that she did. And because I'd wanted to do a play about Nico, and I was listening to that interview, and I thought they're mentioning every song that I love. And it's such a bizarre, you know, interview, because
it's extraordinary.
He's, yeah, he's trying to keep it on track.
Yeah.
And she keeps.
And they're in this darkened room. I mean, it's really amazing stuff. Yes. You know, he's meeting this person he's obviously kind of hugely admires.
Yeah.
And she kind of goes off on these peculiar tangents. Yes. Like, I bet she's probably pretty high at the time.
I don't think she ever managed to really stop doing opiates, which, of course, Marianne did. And one of the things about Broken English that's worth pointing out is that it came after quite a long period where she was just like in the wilderness, wasn't she, Mark?
I mean, she was notoriously kind of basically perched on a wall
in Soho.
She was also living down the World's End, Lots Road, in a kind of house full of junkies.
Yeah,
sort of
like
stuff.
A junkie squad.
She hit the rock bottom that you hear about in NA and so on.
Yes, she did.
And she was still using it at the time for Broken English, wasn't she?
She was.
For a while to come.
She might have been on, I mean, I'm guessing she might have been on methadone. I mean, I mean, Chris Blackwell was certainly taking a chance.
Yeah.
Giving her a record.
And he actually came to the show in 2015.
Did he?
He did.
Oh, fantastic.
And it was wonderful to meet him. It was, you know, I feel so hashtag blessed. Because I do. Because I get to meet, I get to, you know, everybody that I love, I push my way into, you know. So, you know, I got to play with Barry and see, and, you know, Chris Blackwell came to the show, so it was very thrilling. But yeah, she was, I think she went to, I don't think I'm telling tales out of school, because I think she wrote about this, that she went to Hazelden in, I think
Minnesota.
It was 85.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's when she
first
took her last
clean,
shot of heroin.
Maybe it was she struggled a bit with booze for a number of years.
I think after that, you know, she was clean, sober, you know, for several years, and then I don't know exactly what happened, but you know, she still put out brilliant records throughout the, especially Vagabond Ways, you know, which was so beautiful.
I remember vividly when Broken English came out, because our view of her in this country in particular was, first of all, she was this girl who made these very small pop, sort of pop folk records in the 60s.
Yeah.
And then as an appendage to the Rolling Stones.
Right.
And then she disappeared. And then suddenly this record comes out, and it's just nothing like we would have expected to hear.
No.
Yeah. In this extraordinary rapt voice that she's got.
Yeah.
Right. Her voice had been a kind of high, lilting soprano, and then it's, you know, this, like, ravaged, you know,
absolutely,
guttural alto that, you know, is...
And it really took a lot of people by surprise. I mean, the reviews were quite mixed, because I think people just couldn't get their heads around it, or her, you know. What is she?
Sure.
You know?
And it was kind of almost like a new wave record, wasn't
it? Yeah,
it was. Synthesizers. And it very much was of its time. It's very 1979
It
record.
Is, you know, and Steve Winwood's on it, you know, playing all the synth parts. And
fantastic keyboard playing on it. And,
amazing.
I mean, it's just a fabulous record.
Especially on the Ballad of Lucy Jordan.
Oh,
God. You know,
that's so good.
Which, of course, is a Shel Silverstein.
Yeah.
So which I think was it Dr. Hook?
Yes,
Dr.
Hook did it
first.
And then she, I don't think anyone can top her version.
No, it's just superb, isn't it?
It's chilling.
Yeah. And then, of course, the version of Lennon's Working Class Hero.
Which,
at the time, it's like, even if you didn't know her mum was a baronet,
right.
You sort of thought, come on, Marianne. But somehow she gets away with it.
I prefer it to his original.
Oh, wow. Yes.
It's kind of
a darker arrangement, it's very bass-heavy, and
absolutely.
Which is great. Yeah. And she even says in that film that was made of her 1990 performance at St. Anne's in Brooklyn, Blazing Away, and she says
That's Hal Wilner.
That's Hal Wilner, who also just came to it when I did it at Joe's Pub in 2015 or 2014.
I know he said nice things about
it. He has.
And there's no greater seal of approval, really, is there?
I know! Oh, my God. And, you know, again, hashtag best life. Where were we going? Working Class Hero, right.
Yes.
She says in the intro to it that she wanted to see if someone from a different class or class.
Class,
because the American way of saying class doesn't even imply
it's
the
not,
word.
It ain't classy.
It's not class. It's not classy. It's, you know, it's...
Oh, she was a really classy broad.
Oh, that's good. That's a good Brooklyn, you know. Yeah, so from a different class. you know, and she says that if she could feel the same feelings, and she found out that she could, you know, so... she does say that, and, she, you know, so I kind of go into how... I make up how Lennon wrote the song because he was envious of Mick Jagger and all the things that Mick Jagger could do, especially dancing. Just because
it's a great line.
Yeah, I give reasons why Lennon was jealous. I made them up. You know, why Lennon was jealous of Mick Jagger because of his education and his athleticism and his ability to dance on stage, and how John loved Mick's dancing, and I only know this.
All this is pure fabrication.
Yeah, because my husband, who is, you know, a musical compendium, who watched Bohemian Rhapsody with me, pointed out to me years ago that John Lennon has an interview where he says how he hates Mick, and I won't say the word, blank dancing. I think it was from 71. It's a word that starts with F that I would...
And you can say it on this podcast, Tony, I'm afraid.
I wish
we could say that.
No, and it's not the F word that you would think of first. Oh. It's a different... It's a slur of sorts. So,
okay. Is it fake?
No.
Faggy.
With another syllable.
Yeah.
So that kind of... I think that's what he says. Okay. Said. So I just imply that he loved it, and that... and the fact that Mick had Marianne, you know, and that was another reason for John to be envious, and that's why he wrote Working Class Hero.
That sort of takes us on the audio interview.
Well, I was going to say, let's hear this voice.
Apropos of her relationship with all these people, there's a nice clip of where she talks about shagging Keith.
Oh, did you say clip? Or
clip. We're going to listen.
Oh, okay. I thought it was something.
Sorry. Yeah. We don't use that word on the podcast.
I was wondering.
You can say faggot, but not that.
Yeah, because that's a cigarette.
Yeah, that'll get us thrown off iTunes.
Yeah, I know.
You made a very interesting comment on Who Do You Think You Are, about how it's only in your 50s that you learn to sort of enjoy sex and so on, because because that was quite interesting. Kind of, I think a lot of women.
I mean, actually, only with Francois.
Only with Francois, yeah.
And my one night with Keith.
Well,
that was
so great. And he wrote so beautifully about it. Mm.
We had a great night, and we betrayed no one. You know,
no.
It was before I was with Mick, and it was before he was with Anita. We were both completely free, and we just had a great night. So,
I thought Mick came back, and there was a song.
No, that's Keith's story.
Oh, his story. Okay.
I mean, everybody's entitled to their own reality.
It's a great story,
but it's not. That's not true.
No. Okay.
No.
No, that was lovely. Yeah, yeah. Do you wish you had perhaps continued with him, but you've become great friends?
With Keith, I think we would both be dead.
Oh, right, okay.
Addiction and all
I
think he was already in love with Anita.
He was, yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Mm. I love it, you're great friends with Anita. She's
not that much. I love Anita because she's an old friend. But in fact, if she hadn't been with Keith, and it was like a forced friendship, I think.
That's pretty interesting. She's someone who I think has a lot of relationships as men and not many friendships as women. That's the impression I get.
I think she is good friends with a friend of mine who has helped me tremendously, Penny Arcade, the performance artist, who is brilliant, and who Marianne saw her show in the 90s and asked to be in it. And so Penny had her do Why'd You Do It in the show, and they've become... And they're good friends.
Yeah.
Okay.
So... I know that she loves Penny.
She talks about Broken English. She talks about her relationship with her manager slash ex-lover, Françoise Gravard.
Yes, I've heard stories about Françoise.
Oh, yeah, do tell.
Well, they're not complimentary.
Right.
That he is, you know, just a bit of a, perhaps, kind of Colonel Tom Parker, but with benefits, you know.
He's a funny little guy, because I've interviewed Marianne a couple of times, and he's been... kind of hovering around
both times, and he's
not what you'd sort of expect. He's kind of like a French Roberto Benigni or something. He's kind of funny little dark guy who's scurrying around.
Do you remember that notorious Lynn Barber interview with Marianne Faithfull
in the
Observer? And where, first of all, I think Lynn obviously took against Marianne hugely and is fantastically rude about her. But she's also keeps referring to this creepy guy sort of stuff, you know.
Who's telling Marianne what to order or something like that, I think, at the restaurant.
It's 2014 that they haven't been in a relationship. She's obviously still miss... I mean, he left her romantically, even though he stayed as her manager. Mm. And she talks about what a good manager he is and so on. So which I suppose in some ways her ongoing survival as a recording artist and so on possibly does owe something to what he's done.
Yes.
But anyway, she talks about... her family, her son being taken away from her when, and how she now has a good relationship with her son and her grandchildren. Mm-hmm. Though she says she's not really a family person. She doesn't do family, in inverted commas.
Which I understand, because sometimes it's, you know, it's a little bit onerous, it can be, you know.
I think one thing that comes across from this interview is she's supremely selfish.
I guess
are we allowed
to
judge
your
audio subject?
But yes. I don't know if you got the American show Facts of Life, the Facts of Life from the 80s here, but it's about girls in a dormitory school. It was a big pop culture, you know, thing. And Mrs. Garrett, played by Charlotte Ray, who was the kind of matron of this dormitory, said... in a very special episode of The Facts of Life, the word selfish gets a bad rap. And I thought, that's so American and such a great... So maybe she's just self-protective?
Yes,
selfish also is, you know, not a pejorative necessarily.
No, that is fair enough. I mean, she comes across...
I don't want to contradict your reality because, as Marianne says, everybody is entitled to their own reality.
In this interview, she really comes across as a sort of grand dame.
Yes.
She'd done her back in really badly, so she was in some pain. She gives the interviewer quite a hard time.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And at the end of the interview, it's really worth listening to the interview, just listen to the end, where she basically calls an end to it. Right, that's enough. Then the interviewer and a female assistant have to help her out of her chair as she's complaining bitterly. It's really...
Yeah,
she's such a diva. I have to say, listening to this audio, I found her insufferably narcissistic.
Oh, well...
I mean, call a spade a spade. I really did. I just thought, oh, my God, man, you know, you really... You behave as if you are the queen, really.
Well, and I guess, you know, in a way, she is. She's the queen of her particular domain, is herself. And
the mistress of her domain.
The mistress of her domain, yes. And maybe that's part of how she survives. You know, I think, you know, kind of like Mick Jagger, how he, you know, is still... He's not quite jogging around the stage, but he's walking very briskly around the stage, you know, after having a stent put in his heart, because...
She talks about, you know, she hasn't had any contact with Mick at all for years.
Even though he's one of my great friends. The word friends is used a lot
But when Mick's partner died...
Lorraine Scott.
That's right. She sent him an email. I didn't expect a reply. I didn't get one. You know? But then she talks about the rest of them. She says, I see Charlie every now and again. And Keith. Keith's lovely. You know, she's deeply fond of Keith.
Yeah.
And we'll listen to a clip at the end of the show where she talks about, in his book, for the first time, her contribution outside of Sister Morphine to writing lyrics for Stones is acknowledged.
Her input, sort of artistic input. She was very well read.
Yeah. She was.
She didn't come from Dartford in Kent.
No.
And she was well read. She was brought up by sort of upper class bohemian types, wasn't she?
Yeah, I mean, her parents divorced when she was six, and her mother took her to live in Reading, and that's where she went to Catholic school.
Yeah.
And
I think she downplays Reading.
She her father started this kind of commune called Braziers College in Oxfordshire. So
right.
He seemed to be quite a character. She even says in her book that he and his father invented something called the frigidity machine, which was supposed to unleash a woman's libidinous energy.
Oh, those were the days.
I know that, you know, that was before. Perhaps woman's consent was taken, you know, was counted.
Yeah.
Maybe not. I mean, unleashing a woman's energy is
She's a relative
helpful.
Of the Baron from
Sakamasa.
Yeah.
Sadomasochism, yes.
Yeah, because he wrote Venus in Furs.
That's right.
Or as she says at one point, Venus in Pelz, which is the, I guess, German or Austrian.
I mean, she is a great character. I do think, essentially, broken English accepted, I think she's a bit of a fraud.
You do?
I do, I'm afraid. I do. I think most of the music she's made since Broken English, well, a lot of it, let's just say. Her most recent albums have essentially been, she sort of says, I don't like to talk about the past, darling. And yet, everything she does, or her whole shtick is about the legend of Marianne Faithfull.
Yeah, I love that.
You know, it
that,
just doesn't
that
stack
dichotomy
up, really.
Her, you know, that what she says contradicts what she does, but that's very Whitman-esque, isn't it? You know?
So, she'd like that.
Need to move on, don't we?
We do.
We could talk forever about
Marianne.
Well, I just want to, because the featured writer on the homepage this week is the great David Dalton, who is one of the great music writers.
Yeah.
Well, he was one of the original stars of Rolling Stone.
Yes.
So he was there at the very beginning, and he's written tons of books. And, of course, most famously, from our point of view, is he co-author, essentially wrote Marianne's autobiography. So we're going to do a bit more Marianne, filtered through David Dalton, who's very funny about Marianne, and she's very funny about him.
Yeah, she says in one interview that she thinks that it was dear old David Dalton who who made the bulk of her first autobiography about Mick and the Stones. And then, you know, kind of the rest of it was just almost like an epilogue.
Yes. But yeah, she had some... I remember her saying something a bit sort of sniffy about the book. I think it's a terrific read.
Oh, it's a great book.
I mean, every book that David's written is... It's always a terrific read. And
yeah.
So we have three pieces by David, including an interview from 2002 that he did with Marianne, and there's some just funny stuff in there, typical Marianne stuff. Since we've talked enough about her, the one thing I just wanted to note, interestingly, is that, so the album that had just come out at that point was called Kiss and Time,
right?
And there's a song on it, of course, you will know, called Song for Nico.
Song for Nico, yes.
I mean, just briefly, are there parallels between those two that you would say are valid?
Yes, I think they're both blonde, or Nico for a time until she went.
Yeah.
And both of,
that's the
you
most
know,
important thing,
Teutonic
really,
ancestry. And
they both took heroin.
They both took heroin. That's also very salient. And they both acted as well, Nico and La Dolce Vita, and Striptease, which was a fantastic film if you haven't seen it.
No.
I think it's Jean-Luc Poitrineau, is that the filmmaker Serge Gainsbourg, wrote the, like, you know, this stupid pronunciation of mine. He wrote the title song that Nico did, but he used a Juliette Gréco version. But so they both acted. They were both muses for brilliant songs. Nico for I'll Be Your Mirror and perhaps Femme Fatale, although they said that was could be Edie Sedgwick. But they were both, you know, she was a muse for Jackson Brown to a degree. And,
of course. Yeah.
And Leonard Cohen
In the interview, Marianne doesn't want to be regarded as a muse.
Yeah.
And then a moment later claims she's still a muse to everyone.
Yeah, I rest my case.
If
you want to call me a muse, darling, it's your business.
Yeah. It's the dialectic that's so fascinating.
Yeah, exactly.
So
what's amazing, she never met her. She never met me.
She said she saw her once on a plane, maybe in 64, 65.
Right.
The curious thing is we've got the first mention on our site of Nico is a 1965 report about the setting up of Immediate Records.
And
she's at a party with Andrew Oldham, the launch of Immediate, and she was going to release.
And you'd have assumed they would have met.
They'd been in the same room.
Under the aegis of Andrew Luke Oldham.
Yeah, because they both had singles on, you know, Andrew took both of them.
Yeah.
I think he had more success with Marianne.
Oh, yeah.
Because
as Tears Go By was a huge hit.
Yeah, huge hit. And I'm Not Saying, the Gordon Lightfoot song that Nico did, with the flip side being The Last Mile, which was a song that Andrew Oldham wrote with Jimmy Page in what was said in one book in about 10 minutes. And it kind of sounds like it, but they both had a Brian Jones connection. They were both, I don't know if you would say intimate with Brian Jones, but they both...
I think Marianne was not intimate.
Yeah, she says in one interview on a French TV station, she says, he touched my breast, you know. So, and he tried, I think. He just was unable due to the copious consumption of
narcotics. Brian Jones is probably just drunk and just fell over.
Yeah,
and just stopped his fall.
But according to the Richard Witt's book about Nico, according to that, Brian, you know, was with Nico for a while. They were at Monterey Pop together.
They were.
Absolutely right.
Well, there's another... So, actually, that's a perfect segue into... We've just lost D.A. Pennebaker, the great documentary filmmaker. Don D-O-N-N Pennebaker, known to his friends as Penny.
Penny.
An adorable man. I met him a couple of times. I just loved him. And 94 when he died.
Wow.
Last week. 94.
I think it was the Scorsese film that killed him. I really do. I blame Martin.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh,
I mean,
really?
He saw that and he thought, what the hell?
Well, so he, of course, made his two most famous music films are Monterey Pop.
Yeah.
And I think you see Brian and Nika probably wandering
around
the fairgrounds. But even more famously is the Dylan film Don't Look Back.
Yeah, that's why I think the
which documents
recent
the
Scorsese
1965 tour of the UK.
Yeah.
I mean, as it happens, we're also posting an Adam Sweeting interview with Pennebaker from July 1988, and there's a clip in, there's a bit of a moment in that film where this woman who's like the mayoress of whatever town she's visiting kind of ushers her three sons in and is overbearing and pompous, and the question is, was this set up? And Don says, I probably wouldn't be opposed to setting it up if I thought it would work, but what I know is that it never works. The minute you set something up, your protagonist, let's say Dylan, realises what you're doing, and he sees you're making your movie, and he's not interested in your movie. He's maybe interested in his movie and what you can find out about him. But the only reason he's going to give you entree into his life is because you're filming his life, not one you invent for him.
Mm.
Which I think is just, in a sense, that's a sort of documentary filmmaker's creed, really, isn't it?
Yes, yes, yes. Well, this long interview that David Dalton did with Penny Gadfly, April 1999, so really just interesting stuff in there. Actually, one of the funny things, you know, in connection with that and Monterey Pop is there's a very famous shot that you will remember when Janice and Big Brother on stage.
Yeah.
And it cuts to Mama Cass in
with
the crowd, like
them,
going,
yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And what you learn from this interview by David Dalton is that she wasn't reacting to Janice at all. It was just spliced in there.
Oh, that's
it was something else.
Oh,
but he felt it was valid.
It is valid.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because she could have been doing that with Janice and you didn't know, or it could have been internal.
Yes, exactly. But Pennebaker, so he was 94, so he was a lot older than Dylan and any of the artists that he was making films about that time. But he was one of the first documentary filmmakers to work in that field. Albert Grossman came to him, would you be interested in making a film about about Dylan.
Yeah.
In his Sweeting interview, he's very fond of Albert Grossman, actually.
He was fond of Albert.
Everyone else sort of treated him as just this monster in a way, but Pennebaker actually has a lot of time for him.
Exactly. And I mean, I think anyone who's seen Don't Look Back, I've probably seen it 3 or 4 times. I mean, it's a brilliant film. Not just about Dylan, but about the business of being on the road. I mean, the famous scenes with like Tito Burns, all this extraordinary stuff going on, and it really is. It is cinema verite. Yeah. You know, he's just there with this. He actually invented a lightweight 16mm camera in order to be able to do much more sort of you know off the cuff stuff, and that was partly what gave him the freedom that he had.
We've seen bits of the subsequent tour film he did with Bob Dylan with the band, which is, in terms of film of live music, some of the best live music I've seen shot. It's just fantastic.
Gorgeous, and gorgeous music. And what also I liked about Don't Look Back is the relationship between Dylan and Joan Baez. You know, just that dynamic was...
I thoroughly enjoyed the public humiliation of Donovan. That gave me a great deal of pleasure.
He really was. But here's a funny little thing that I learned from David's interview, is that the famous signs that Dylan left at the beginning when they're playing Subterranean Homesick Blues, most of those were actually drawn or written by Donovan.
He was useful.
Donovan, make yourself useful.
Didn't he write Sea of Green for Yellow Submarine? They couldn't come up with a rhyme, so he came up with...
You could be right.
I'm not sure, but again...
He's a useful guy to have around.
He was.
Though he has an appallingly high opinion of himself, which really isn't justified by...
Again, keeps him alive. You know, that kind of thing. You know, and he wrote some lovely, you know... Season of the Witch.
Sunshine Superman. I like
the fact that he gave the Allman Brothers the basis for Mountain Jam. I think that's about as far as I'll go.
There you go. Can you pronounce the name of the song that they nicked for it?
No, I can't.
It's very difficult, isn't it? So we won't try that. It's really important that we mark the passing of D.A. Pennebaker because I think he's one of the great music filmmakers.
Yes.
I mean, he made other films. He made Town Hall Party, which I think has that great row between Norman Mailer and Jermaine Gray.
That's fantastic. Right,
Town Hall Party. He made some great films, but Don't Look Back and Monterey Pop would even mainly be... Ziggy Stardust, of course. He made Bowie's Ziggy Stardust
which
film.
He did a film of Depeche Mode, didn't he? Quite an extensive film.
Yes, he did. He was still kind of relevant and had cachet even at that point. He worked out of this extraordinary warren of offices. Did you ever go to his offices on East 90-something Street?
No, I'd never.
And you'd get lost because it was just this sort of rabbit warren of very dark offices and then Penny would be right at the end of it. He was such a nice man. There was no airs and graces. Yeah. He was a delightful human being and I think we missed by many. Just back briefly to David Daughton. So we've run also... He was very close to Janis Joplin and did 2 or 3 of the big pieces about Janis before she died for Rolling Stone. And one of them we're running this week, it's from August 1970, and it's an interview with Janis in Louisville, Kentucky, where she's just played with her new band, her newish band, Full Tilt Boogie Band, probably the best band musically that she had.
Yeah.
And it's great. There's a famous documentary, or famous footage of a tour that she was on that went across Canada on a train.
Oh.
And the Grateful Dead were on it.
Right.
And
band
Danko was on there. And you can see... So there's these amazing scenes of Janis singing bluegrass songs with Jerry Garcia.
Yeah.
Playing like a mandolin. And Rick, very drunk, Rick Danko, harmonising with her. And then you can see David's impish face sitting at the back, you know. That's a claim to fame.
It definitely is. Yeah. Especially to be with, you know, Jerry Garcia and Janis and Rick Danko all together. That's...
Absolutely. It was all-star heaven. So David Daughton, he's the featured writer. Those are the pieces by him. And, of course, Faithful, the autobiography.
Yes.
Is always worth reading.
Yeah.
The other free stuff on the homepage this week is to do with Miles Davis, whose incredibly important, influential album, In a Silent Way, is 50 years old. Is this year. 50 years since In a Silent Way.
I mean, I have a severely autistic daughter, and when she decides she likes a piece of music, that's all she will listen to. And for about a year, about a year and a half ago, every time I'd see her, we'd listen to In a Silent Way.
Really? I thought it was always Electric Lady.
She moved from In a Silent Way to Electric Lady seamlessly. Wow. But for a long time, we would listen to In a Silent Way. And if you listen, extraordinary, if you listen to it kind of three times a week for a year,
you don't get bored with it.
You really don't. Yeah. I mean, it's an extraordinary record because it's basically stitched together in the edit suite by Tia Masira, the producer.
Yeah.
There's only one previous Miles song, maybe Miss Mabry or whatever it's called, on
Fio de Kilimanjaro,
which is
the beginning of that sort of phase.
Which is the first point towards what...
Yeah.
But otherwise, it's an incredibly revolutionary album.
Yes, it was.
And I'd say that some of the best playing by people like John McLaughlin ever did is on that record.
So it's this incredible group of musicians, some from the previous Miles era and some going forward.
Yeah, but apparently Herbie Hancock was just walking past the studio.
Right.
His face appeared in the window and Miles beckoned him in.
So it's Wayne Shorter, who'd obviously been playing with Miles for a while, John McLaughlin, as you mentioned, Chick Corea, Herbie Hancock, Joe Zawinul. I mean, three extraordinary keyboard players.
Yeah.
Dave Holland on bass and the great Tony Williams on drums.
Yeah.
But it's really unlike anything that had been
recorded before. It's a really delicate record.
Delicate, exactly.
You know, Miles got noisier later. Stuff I love, Jack Johnson.
The Bitches Brew is the one immediately followed.
Exactly. But this record has got very still and quiet moments. And one section is just repeated wholesale at the beginning of side two and at the end of side two.
Mm.
It's just basically the same recording doubled up. So the actual total recording time is only like 25 minutes for this album.
Yes.
It's fabulous.
That's very punk rock too. It's like the Ramones.
Yeah.
I mean, there was something quite punk about Miles, wasn't there? I mean, I always think of him in terms of his just taking no shit from anyone.
Yeah.
No.
Like, a bit like Dylan. He's almost like the Black Dylan in that era. He was so intimidating to people and so brilliant. And this record, so Don Snow wrote this piece for us 10 years ago, a sort of hymn of praise
in
a Silent Way. And he sort of calls it almost like the first ambient album.
Just
he makes claims where he says, you know, everyone says Eno is the sort of godfather of ambient. I would say this album is like the beginning of ambient. And also it points to things like sort of dub and chill and all sorts of things. I mean, it's real sort of ground zero for a certain kind of...
But the extraordinary thing is there's never been a record like it since, not even by Miles. You know,
no.
I've never heard any record which creates the same atmosphere.
No. You consider what a powerful drummer Tony Williams is and how restrained...
Apparently, he was pissed off that he was being told to play such minimal parts.
Just stick to the hi-hat.
That he willfully played as quietly as he could just to try and piss off Miles.
Okay. Well, talking of Miles and pissing off Miles, there's a couple of other pieces.
The other reason that he thought that he was setting up Lifetime at that point.
Yes.
And first of all, his keyboard player from Lifetime was meant to play in the session. He ordered him away.
Okay.
You're not playing on the session. I'm not having Miles steal my band. Because John McLaughlin, who's also going to be in Lifetime, was on the session. So Tony Williams was really just terrified that Miles was basically going to pinch his entire band.
So I just also added this piece by Al Aronowitz from October 1970, and it's just really a short account of just hanging out with Miles in New York, and he just writes very beautifully about this transformation, because the transformation is not just, you know, the use of electric instruments and funk rhythms, but the whole look of Miles and his musicians changed very suddenly. So I'll just read this bit from Al's piece. To a whole generation of uptown pimps and West Side junkies, East Village poets and midtown jet setters, West Village hustlers and closet heads of suburbia, Miles has been New York's living definition of cool, hunched over his trumpet like a bantamweight boxer, the figure of a question mark, dressed in a short, tight jacket with skinny lapels and slanted pockets. except now he was wearing snakeskin pants and a suede vest with long fringes. I asked him how come, but he didn't answer.
Well, I can tell you how come. It's Betty Davis, Miss Mabry.
Oh.
She started getting him to wear caftans and all this kind of hippie shit, you know. And she was the one who turned him on to funk. He actually, in his autobiography, gives her a great deal of credit. You know, she was an important person for him.
Harvard, and she was tuned into Jimi Hendrix and Sly Stone and all
of
that.
One of the problems he had was that she was sleeping with Jimi Hendrix.
Be problematic, but...
but creatively, it kind of worked.
Marianne, to bring it back to Marianne Faithfull, as, you know, everything comes back to Marianne, she says well, that she regrets not sleeping with Jimi Hendrix more than she regrets not sleeping with Dylan. So it all ties in.
Because Dylan definitely wanted to sleep.
He wanted
to. I mean, we're going to sort of slightly go in circles here.
It was during that Kennebaker era that she met him at the Savoy, I think.
Well, so, I think Betty Davis kind of needs to be given credit where it's due.
Not the Betty Davis Hollywood fan. The goddess of funk.
And she made almost good records herself. Mm. He was a big freak.
He was a big freak!
I mean, this is some really good stuff there.
Yes, yes. So that's Miles, 50 years since In a Silent Way, and the beginning of his, you know, jazz rock interlude. And that's essentially everything that's free on RBP. So we've done Marianne, we've done Dylan, we've done Ben Baker, we've done Miles. We're now going to address what's new on RBP for the subscriber to Rock's Back Pages.
Yeah, Melody Maker 68. The Birds were in London to play... only a kind of handful of fairly small-scale dates. This is the Graham Parsons version of the Birds. Roger McGuinn being interviewed. He says, I don't think we'll go into country music 100%, but it's pure and it hasn't really been done by pop artists. It's a fresh area. And of course, in fact, that was also the end of Graham Parsons' involvement because that's the point where he left the band because they were due to go to South Africa.
Yeah, it was. And also slightly disingenuous on McGuinn's part, I think, because I think he saw... McGuinn wasn't really a country fan, and it was Chris Hillman who brought Graham into the fold.
Right.
And I think McGuinn was actually quite threatened by Graham's country chops.
Didn't he erase all his vocals on Sweetheart of the Rodeo?
But that was only because Graham was under contract to Lee Hazelwood.
Oh,
it wasn't because he was trying to eliminate Graham from the thing. There are...
It was a win-win for Jim McGuinn.
Well, on this article, Graham is credited with singing lead on a whole bunch of stuff. So certainly live, at least, Graham was singing that stuff.
Oh.
And they famously played the Grand Ole Opry and caused a real scandal.
Yeah. Jerry Gilbert interviews Arthur Lee of Love, Melody Maker 1970. It's not a desperately interesting interview. You know, it comes up with things like, I believe that European musicians are generally overrated. The people they get their thing from aren't getting a fourth of the credit, which is basically about the people like the Stones stealing black music. But it's interesting that it's an Arthur Lee interview. There aren't many of them, you know. And that was the point when he's still, notionally, the band was called Love, but this is like the third iteration of it, and was basically a fairly boring kind of hard rock band, would you say?
Yeah, who was in the guest seat the other day making it was Chris Campion was making claims
a case for
the post Forever Changes Love, which didn't really fly with us.
I was very, my brother bought all those records, I was very familiar with them, and I kind of liked some of them enough, For Sale and so on.
Of course, Hendrix plays on Everlasting First.
And in a couple of weeks' time, we're going to be putting another interview with Arthur Lee, where he talks about the album he did with Jimmy, which never got released.
I mean, Arthur, in a way, he sort of fits into that conversation we were having about Miles and Jimmy and Sly, the kind of, you know, the almost that sort of black hippie thing. And Arthur probably was the guy who started that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, there's no doubt Hendrix was really influenced by the way that Arthur Lee looked.
Well, they met in 64. Arthur was producing, and again, this is from the audio interview, which is going up in a couple of weeks, yeah, that Arthur had written was producing a single for an R&B artist.
Rosalie Brooks.
Yes, that's right. And he wanted someone who could play Curtis Mayfield-ish guitar.
Oh.
And someone said, there's this guy, Jimi Hendrix, who can do that, which, of course, is one of the things Jimi really, really can do.
Yeah.
And that's when they first met. They were friends for a long time.
Yeah.
Michael Jackson's Off the Wall was viewed by David Hepworth, the fans. And actually, David Hepworth really gets it right, that Off the Wall is half a great record. Mm. And the half that's great is so great, it's just unbelievable. And the other half is really
drecky.
The second side ballads.
Mm. Oh, yeah. Well, ballads tend to drag things down.
Well, I mean, actually, this is what he says. Disco might actually have been designed for him. His voice always comes on like backflips of second nature. And if we're going to have to listen to anybody singing the telephone book, I'll take Michael Jackson anytime. The first side of Off the Wall is occupied by a clutch of dancers that must have even Nile Rodgers and Bernard Edwards watching their backs. Don't stop till you get enough. Working day and night and get on the floor. Jackson compositions all. A more than efficient pegs for his hang gliding, astonishingly agile voice. Smooth grooves at every one of them and loaded with hookery and trickery. David Hepworth gets it absolutely about
and
about
that's,
right.
And that's without even mentioning the Rod Temperton songs. Like, there's some more mid-tempo, like Rock With You.
Yeah.
It's probably my favourite tracker. And Off the Wall itself.
I mean, I know that there's this sort of... Some people think that because of what's emerged about Michael since... that his artistry should sort of somehow be negated. And I just can't do that.
I can't either.
Yeah. And nor should we. I think it's preposterous.
No.
I mean, Don't Stop Till You Get Enough is one of the most revolutionary records, dance records ever made,
I think.
It's phenomenal.
Such a beautiful, a gorgeous singer and such a percussive singer, you know.
Well, yeah, because it's not a beautiful voice, actually. Well, the timbre of it is not, it's not a big, beautiful, rich voice.
Yeah,
but,
when he was little, it was, and then,
yes,
you know, if you
it's
hear
a kind
those,
of thin voice, but it's,
it is.
But what he does with it.
Well, it's rhythmic.
It's percussive, as you say.
Yeah.
Yes, I mean, and that's exactly what Hepworth's saying, is that there's no difference between the way he dances and the way he sings.
Yes.
They're one and the same
that's
thing.
That's it.
Piece 1982, Michael Goldberg interviewing Tom Fogerty, brother of John Fogerty, and had been a member of Creedence Clearwater. And he's saying, it's very sad. Tom hasn't seen his brother for a long time. His brother had made a solo album 7 years before and had gone silent. And there's lots of different itches being scratched here. Tom says, Creedence was together for 9 years before we made it big, and 60% of that time, I was the lead singer. I wasn't a dictator, but I was more of a leader than what I ended up to be in the eyes of our fans. Just the guy who stood there and played rhythm guitar. So after we were into our sixth platinum album, I thought maybe I could do a little singing, but John was not going to change things, so I split. They did kind of kiss and make up as brothers, and he talks about how the band got together again for Tom's wedding reception, and they thought they were going to get together again, and John just disappeared off again.
Brothers in rock, eh?
Yeah,
brothers
in rock. Few of them around, haven't
I? Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know. I think it's that last album that they did with Fogerty, and he only sings lead vocal on two songs, I think.
The very last one. Was that?
It was where he sings Hello, Mary Lou.
Yeah.
His vocals just, it's hard to beat him.
John.
As a vocalist and a songwriter.
Yeah,
one of the great singers.
In a sense, it's sad because, you know, Tom obviously recognises that John was a real talent, but just feels bruised by the fact that he is not regarded as being an important member of the band.
Well, it's the Salieri thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know.
So, now we go to 86. Now, Nick Coleman interviewing Anita Baker. Now, I saw the show that she played that the day before this interview took place or whatever, and it's one of the best things I've ever seen in my life. Niece Baker, the time when you go and see an R&B act and there'll be costume changes, there'll be medleyization of your favourite songs. Mm-hmm. There's none of that with her. She just, for an hour and a half, sung in front of a really good band as part of the band. It's fantastic. And she comes over wonderfully in this interview. She says, oh, I love tenor saxophones. I love thick sounds, fat sounds, sounds that have abandon. You know, I mean, she is a musician. She says, I've never been a prissy woman. I don't want no one to carry my luggage. I'm okay on my own. I'm self-content. Mm. She also says, black artists sometimes have to sacrifice personal taste for survival, for financial freedom, and need that for any kind of freedom in this country. She comes over in this interview really wonderfully. I mean, I really have a lot of time for her. Last thing is another Barbara Ellen piece, who's one of my favourites, and it's at the time when Paula Yates, there's the ongoing, she basically kind of documents the ongoing saga of Paula Yates.
Do you know who Paula Yates was?
Yeah, I do. Bob Geldof.
And Michael Hutchence's.
Right, right. The
Squeeze as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Paula had her house been raided, found some opium and some pornographic pictures, which it turned out are actually just pictures of her and Michael shagging. So, you know, nothing particularly grotesque there, just a bit feeble.
But, was it feeble?
Yeah,
but, were they that graphic you could see the...
It wasn't good sex.
Yeah,
it was feeble sex.
I don't know if that's the answer. I mean, the thing is, she was being tried by the tabloids. Because of all of this, you know, suddenly everyone turned on her, and Barbara says Yates's biggest public relations problem is that she's, to use taxi driver vernacular, a bit of a stupid cow, a consummate self-publicist with no common sense or dignity to speak of. She's been wandering the corridors of showbiz in too tight / too young clothes too damn long now to merit anything like automatic respect. What, after all, can one say in defence of a woman who started out as a groupie and went downhill from there?
That's
one paragraph in the piece. Yeah. She's actually broadly supportive of Paula, saying she's hard to support because of what I've just sort of said. But
I think those are positive traits.
but she goes on to say that basically Paula Yates' treatment is misogyny, misogyny, misogyny. And there's a lot of truth in that. Anyway, that's my selection. Have you got anything sort of particularly?
Not particularly, not really. Nothing particularly to talk about this week.
We've got a sort of 7-2 interview with Keith Richards by Roy Carr about the making of Exile on Main Street.
Yes, not about Marianne Faithfull.
Not about Marianne Faithfull. No, she was gone by then. I mean, not gone, but she was on the wall.
Off the wall.
And if you're a Stones fan, you'll want to read the interview, but it's not desperately interesting. Keith started giving good quote about sort of 15 years ago.
Yeah.
Before then, he could be pretty dull in interviews.
I don't know. Those I find most fascinating when they don't have their codified responses or their Rashomon-like memories of what happened, you know, which could change.
I mean, the other thing is that probably by when this interview took place, he was almost certainly on heroin. This is 72.
Yeah.
And so he was probably just like kind of mumbling replies to the questions.
Yeah.
And it comes out.
But then it's more fun to try and decipher. Like, it's like lyrics where you have to figure out, oh, what is that, instead of...
Yeah, except...
No, not really.
Well, Keith has always been, I mean, certainly for a long time, been much more sort of candid and just sort of spontaneous with his thoughts than Mick.
With an extraordinary accent.
Yeah. So he doesn't really care what he says, and we know that from his book in a way.
I love that the journalist Bill Wyman, who wrote Mick's response to Keith's book.
Yes.
It was one of the best, funny, it's on Salon magazine.
Oh, right, I remember that, and I don't remember what it was, and I feel like such a bad Stones fan for not remembering. I'm a bad Stones fan. I didn't see them on this tour either.
Well, dig it out. It's brilliant piece of writing. You know, he's writing as Mick Jagger in response to Keith's book.
Yeah.
You know, so, well, you know, you didn't have to prop up an alcoholic on the stage for the last 25 years.
Oh, that's right. That was very good. I remember Elton John didn't he refer to Keith Richards as an arthritic monkey? I think. Was that, am I misremembering again? Yeah. It is. I mean, you know, they were just in New Jersey.
Yeah,
at a diner.
With two other guys playing all the guitar parts for Keith, because he can't really play anymore.
Yeah,
you look at his hands, and that's serious kind of arthritic sort of stuff going on.
Yeah, so Elton wasn't too far off the mark, was he? No. But and right, Ronnie is.
Ron is Ronnie. God, I've never liked that band since he joined.
No,
no,
not even.
No,
yeah. I'm trying to think of Some Girls.
So Some Girls is not a bad album, but I mean, for me, it's the 4 years, 68 to 72.
Yeah,
That's it. I don't like so stuff before. I don't like.
You're not a Brian Jones, not the blues stuff or the poppy not when they were trying to be Small Faces kind of stuff.
Not really, no. Right. Small Faces.
I love Steve Marriott so much. I do.
That's another show.
Oh, no, if I had that kind of voice.
You're going to have to do a male performer at some point.
Well, I've done Mick.
Have you done Mick?
Well, I had a Stones band for... Since 1999, we started with my friend Jill Richmond, who's now doing publicity for Bernard Fowler's new record.
It's a small world. That's how Bernard came to be sitting
where
he's sitting
Jill
now.
That's right. Yeah. And Jill was, she said to me, when we first met, I had been signed to Bug Music, the music company, and she was working for Bug. And she said to me, do you want to start a band? You'll be the singer, I'll be the guitar player. And she had a name for the band already. The people thought I came up with, no, it was Jill, and it was... I don't know if I can say this, but it was we called ourselves, and it's...
You're going to say it.
It's a joke. It's not...
We can always take it out.
It's called the Mike Hunt Band. And
I don't get it.
It's a common name in America. And so I said, how about just do the Rolling Stones?
Yeah.
Because we both were huge Stones fans. And I said, because nobody wants to hear what we have to say. You know, there's no interest in what, like, you know, our nocturnal thoughts. And so I said to her, why don't we just do albums in their entirety? And this was 99, and people hadn't been doing that.
No.
And I'm taking freaking credit for this
whole... Yeah, take it, babe.
You know, at Arlene's Grocery, it started Owen Komaski, who was doing Ziggy Stardust, and then we started doing... The first one we did was, you know, the classic, what everybody wants to hear when you do a Stones band, Tattoo You. And we actually skipped a song. We skipped the song Heaven because it was just kind of this ethereal, you know, quasi-pseudo-Indian chanting. And we thought, no, that nobody wants to hear.
Skip.
Yeah. It's like when you're, you know, but, yeah. And then we started doing, and we became friends with these Stones fans who go to every Stone show, and they have a Stones convention every year in Wildwood, New Jersey, and we were playing that, and... I was just Mick. I didn't imitate him per se. I just, you know, talk like this and be really bitchy, you know, make fun of, you know, Mick Taylor and all that, you know, where he's playing at Wetlands on a Tuesday night, you know, like, you know, and it's just, you know, and just be really.
So it sort of took off from there.
It took off from there. So
that idea.
Yeah. And so we started doing, and then just a few years ago, we started without Jill because she was teaching, and just a few years ago we were doing Stones albums at this, you know, cabaret club where I'm doing the Marianne Faithful show. We did
Pangea.
Yeah, Pangea. Yeah. We did all those four for 4 weeks. We, you know, once a week we would do, first we did Beggar's Banquet, then we skipped Get Your Gaza, then Let It Bleed, then Exile, and then Sticky Fingers, but without drums. So that was a big revolutionary way that we did it. And then we did Satanic Majesties almost a year ago with drums, which was...
Now without it, drums.
Yeah.
Well, we are really out of time, but we'll just bring it full circle just to remind listeners, especially in the greater metropolitan area of New York City, that you are performing Broken English, kind of as Marianne. In late September. There are previews starting in mid-September.
September 12th
September 25th
to
19th. Is the main
date. The
opening night at Pangea with Barry Reynolds, Marianne's original collaboration guitar player. It sounds like it's going to be terrific.
Yeah.
I wish it wasn't 3,000 miles away.
I know. It's bizarre. I'll just say that. It's bizarre. And
Have fun. Enjoy it.
Thank you for having me, too.
Well, it's been a pleasure.
It's been a great pleasure talking to you about Marianne and everything else. And we wish you a safe trip home.
Absolutely.
Oh, thank you.
Yes.
Look forward to seeing you, you know, perform maybe in London one day, or maybe we'll get over to New York.
Anytime.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And we're going to, Mark.
Yeah, we're going to go out with a clip of Marianne talking about how Keith acknowledged her contributions to the writing the Rolling Stones songs.
Great.
Okay.
We'll be back next week, or at least I will be back next week.
I'll be sunning myself in Italy.
Mark won't be here. Jasper and I should be, fingers crossed, all things being equal, hosting Ian Penman, who has a new collection out. Ian Penman, sometimes regarded as the most pretentious writer on pop music ever. We think he's become one of the greatest writers.
He's
on
a writer,
pop
and
music.
His name is Penman.
Penman, yes. Exactly. It's not that, bad. I mean, you know.
You know, what else could he do with
what
that name?
We actually have another writer on the site whose real name is Ian Penman.
Had to change
it. Change it because Ian Penman was Ian Penman.
There wasn't room for two Ian Penmans. No. So anyway, all things being equal, yeah. Jasper and I'll be here next week with Ian Penman. Until then, toodle pip and bye from all of us.
Bye.
What really helped me a lot was when Keith wrote his book.
Yeah.
He did write about how much I did and how much I helped with the songwriting.
Yeah.
Finally, somebody said it, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not that people haven't asked me. It's just that I'd never felt it was my place to say.
Yeah.
And it's not.
But yes, you've finally got credit for Sister Morphine. Yeah.
A lot more than Sister Morphine.
Yeah,
but I didn't get actual credit, but I got credit from Keith.
Yes, sure. Yeah. Do you get royalties still from some of those songs you wrote?
No, I don't. I get royalties from Sister Morphine.
Yeah.
That's fine. I don't mind about anything else.
Yeah.
I wasn't there for the money, you know, at all.
That was Marianne Faithful in conversation with Maureen Payton in 2014, concluding this week's Rocks Back Pages podcast. Many thanks to special guest Tammy Faye Starlight, who'll be performing Marianne Faithful's Broken English at Pangaea starting in September. For details, please visit pangaeanyc.com. The hosts are Barney Hoskins and Mark Pringle, and the producer was Jasper Murison Bowie. You can find thousands of articles, as well as hundreds of full-length audio interviews, at rocksbackpages.com. Why'd you spit on my